My name is Kevin Murphy, and this is the Mission Innovation Podcast.
I often say, you know, one of the necessities of courageous conversation in life is understanding that half of all of our conversations are mediated through loss and disappearance.
David White is a well-known international poet, philosopher, and a scientist whose voice has helped us shape the meaning of workplaces and in turn helped us become more authentic persons and leaders. In my conversation with him, he explored the themes of responding to disruption, the experience of loss, work-life balance, vocation, and finally the need for us to cultivate both vulnerability and a relationship with silence. David, given the success of your writing and your work today, how did the journey of making these connections between our identity, our work, and our lives begin for you? How did you start?
Well, I suppose it started very early, just as writing poetry started very early. I started writing or recognizing poetry as something I wanted to do when I was 7 or 8 years old. And I listened to a lot of it from my mother before that time. And I think, you know, in poetry, you're both witness and completely present at the same time. And I always felt, especially through my mother's eyes, that I was witnessing other people's lives and trying to make sense of them. My mother was a very compassionate person, and if there was any trouble in the neighborhood, the person would almost always be at my mother's kitchen table because she could walk an Irish mile in someone else's shoes with no trouble, and people recognized that. And I think I started to see the world in the same way. I remember when I got older, I asked her, how did she manage to be so compassionate for other people's troubles? Because my mother had had so much trouble in her own life growing up. And she said, well, you know, when you hear someone's story and you understand what their troubles are, you always forgive them and you always have an understanding. So I just act as if I know the story already, even if I don't. So that was quite some advice. And I just started really paying attention to lives other than my own and to what I felt needed to be witnessed and spoken about those lives. And that's why I started writing too, because I felt it was a way of making sure that frontier was completely alive and was expanding, because poetry is always a way of overhearing yourself say things you didn't know you knew about the world. So I slowly started working my way into poetry, and it's a very long story because I had an excursion into sciences when I was in my teens.
Yes, you're a naturalist as well.
And then into university, you know, into marine zoology, and then returned to poetry again in my 20s. So my mother and poetry are the two answers to that question. And, you know, Coleridge, the great romantic poet, said that no poet begins in philosophy or they write very bad poetry, but every poet becomes a philosopher. And part of where poetry has led me is into what I call the phenomenology of conversation, which is what happens along the way when you try to have a real one, to have a real conversation. And I've always been interested in that frontier between what you think is you and what you think is not you. I suppose because I was invited soon after I became a full-time poet in my early 30s, I was invited into the corporate world to my great surprise. And I brought that kind of perspective to bear on vocation and on work and on the dynamics, the difficult dynamics people have when they're trying to accomplish an endeavor together.
Was there a particular job or a particular, maybe even a first job that was the experience of being passionate about work, of tapping into those deeper levels of vocation or witnessing within a work environment?
That's a very good question. I think that, you know, I had lots of jobs from when I was quite young. I always had paper rounds and
right.
worked in all the woolen mills during my holidays and worked for my father's company digging holes for electric cables. And all of those summer and holiday jobs. But my first real work was, my first job in the world was quite extraordinary. It was as a naturalist guide in the Galapagos Islands. So there was no way you could remain dispassionate as a naturalist guide in the Galapagos Islands. It was incredible.
Sure.
Yes. And yet still, you know, you had lots of human dynamics to work with around. You were a crew member aboard a boat. You took a watch. You had to get on with the cook, with the captain, with the crew members, and with the people you were leading around the islands. And you had to be an educator and a policeman all at the same time. So it was definitely a job that involved leadership and involved challenges on many different fronts all at once. Yeah, one of the things about leadership is a kind of 360-degree visibility in which you're being called on from all sides. And you're being seen from all sides, not only for your virtues and your powers, but also your flaws and difficulties are recognized by everyone else almost immediately. So yes, I'd say that job really informed my sense of being passionate in the work.
David, have you had an experience recently with healthcare? As a witness, as an observer, and what struck you about that experience as you experienced healthcare in action?
Oh, both my sisters are nurses, so I'm constantly hearing stories. They're nurses in Britain. And then, of course, I have friends who are ill and some who have passed away within the system or in palliative care or at home. And then I've got the experiences I have when I'm working inside North American and European healthcare. And I often think of something Oscar Wilde said about someone he knew. When I think of North American healthcare, he said he has no enemies, but is intensely disliked by all his friends. And the interesting dynamic about North American healthcare is almost everyone, you know, realizes there's something extremely flawed about it. At the same time, almost everyone is also extremely dedicated. So you get this extremely flawed system with extremely dedicated and often quite caring people. And so often the moving moments are the people who are able to bridge, you know, between the flawed system and making a real contact with a human being who is in the throes of illness or is passing away inside that that hospital room or inside the palliative care room. So that's where I find it most moving. I mean, the great thing about the medical profession is that the stakes are so high. It's literally life and death. Even if it's just the beginning of a diagnosis, you are being faced with a conversation with mortality. And you're faced with the metamorphosis of your identity. You know, when you go into a room and you're given a diagnosis, particularly a serious diagnosis, you have a completely different and radicalized identity when you emerge from that room than when you first went in. And doctors and nurses are present to that on a daily basis. And my sister in England is in a nursing home. She's literally sat by the beds of hundreds of people who have died and helped, you know, keep them alive for years before they went, and then helped them go across on the other side. I mean, this is this informs the way you look at people who consider themselves completely healthy. You know that it's just a matter of time before we all actually have to face that deep and troubling question. I often say, you know, one of the necessities of courageous conversation in life is understanding that half of all of our conversations are mediated through loss and disappearance, either of others around us or of our own sense of ourselves. Yeah. And that human beings are therefore constantly looking for a different life that is not this life that we have. We're constantly saying, in effect, listen, God, if this is the game you want me to play, I'm not going to play it. I'm going to find some other life which doesn't involve this loss and disappearance and humiliation and heartache. And the only way that I can escape is by actually abstracting myself from my body and from my sense of presence. I think this is one of the reasons we unconsciously have all of these systems, whether it's our educational systems or our medical systems, which are constantly abstracting ourselves from the spirit of the very thing we're trying to work with. We're all familiar with the doctor's abstraction from compassion, having faced so much difficulty and loss. You start to create a defended professional armor that keeps you from feeling other people's difficulties simply because you don't know how to integrate it yourself into your own system. I've noticed it particularly with psychiatrists that because they're working with vulnerable population where the victories are so small, you know, in psychiatry, you're quite often just trying to stop a person harming themselves. You're trying to stop them harming their loved ones. You're trying to stop them being thrown out of their houses. You're trying to just actually have them have a modicum of an ordinary life. I think it can be quite soul destroying on the psychiatrist, on the physician, who, despite their best hopes when they first went into the profession, are unable to create that great victory that they first went in to achieve.
Sure.
So this always throws us back on these very existential senses of who am I as a human being and how do I hold this conversation? And those conversations are almost always held along an axis of vulnerability, which unfortunately we've often seen vulnerability as a weakness. So one of the things I work with in conversation with physicians and with leadership is how do you create a robust vulnerability? You have no choice about being vulnerable, no more than any of your patients who are in difficulty. And when you think about it, all conversations end when vulnerability ends. If you're trying to have a conversation at home with a loved one, if there's no vulnerability, there's no conversation. And if you're trying to have a real conversation with your colleagues, the vulnerability looks very different than at home, but it's nonetheless vulnerability. It's the vulnerability we talked about earlier of being seen, being visible, being touchable, and therefore being very hurtable and being seen for your flaws and difficulties in public. So the whole thing is about vulnerability, really, and yet so many of our professions have to do with creating this armored personality. So it's certainly true in all of our medical associations and medical professional bodies that we have. It's true in our educational bodies, you know. I often say in poetry, and if you really want to kill your love of poetry, then sign up for a university course in it. That will do it very quickly indeed. And we, all of our structures, I feel, are on the edge of, what's the word? A reimagination, and especially in our approaches to health and mortality through medicine.
David, the scenarios you just drew caused me to think of your work, the book, The Three Marriages, Reimagining Work, Self, and Relationship. And there you said the kind of framework of a work-life balance is an inaccurate framework, or it's certainly not a robust one. And you point out another framework for us. Can you kind of lead us through that framework you propose?
Yeah. Well, there's a reason why the word balance almost never appears in poetry. It's a very tedious word. And it's a production of the strategic mind that's constantly trying to measure things. And it has a place in our world. But it's often trying to measure things that can't be measured. They're meant to be put in relationship to each other rather than measured against each other. They're meant to be put in conversation with one another. So work-life balance often has us working even harder than before we thought of the concept. You know, so when I have the idea of work-life balance, I I think, well, I've done all this hard work in the office. Now I need to run home and do all this hard work at home and around the chores. And then I need to do all this hard work around my relationship. And then I need to do all this hard work around being a good parent. So it's quite exhausting. And the way we understand the artistic imagination in poetry is that it's actually a place to stand at the center of things, where you have a kind of fulcrum which addresses the whole pattern. So the poetic imagination is not the ability to think up new things, it's the ability to stand at the center of the pattern and hold a tonality or an image or an understanding that is able to make sense of the whole pattern. And so I felt like what was at the center of the pattern was the way human beings are constantly making promises with their world. And their first promise is to someone they want to love in the world or be loved by. You know? And that often takes the form of what we call a marriage. Well, the second marriage is the promise you often make to your vocation or work. And I often say tongue-in-cheek that work must be a marriage, because otherwise, why would you have put up with so much over all the years? You must have made a vow to something larger than the knit and the grit and the difficulty of the everyday. You must have a horizon in your work to which you promised yourself. Yeah? And that's what helps you make sense of often very insensible hours and days, you know, of working within a large system or a bureaucracy, is the fact that you have this horizon to which you have dedicated you with, and it makes sense of everything, even though the system doesn't make sense. And then the third promise is perhaps the most difficult promise of all, and that's the promise you've made to that tricky, movable frontier called yourself, the person looking back at you in the mirror, but the person who's also tidal and seasonal as they move through their lives. You know, the interesting dynamic about a relationship with the self is that you almost always meet your new self in the form of a stranger. And you almost always reject that stranger to begin with and send it away until it keeps returning, and you have to face towards it and realize that actually this is the new you. And this is the person you would not have recognized a few years ago that you are just about to become. So I call those the three marriages, or the three vows, or the three promises. And rather than balancing them out and making them into commodities and simple work projects, my understanding is that we're meant to put them in conversation with one another. That they're mutually supporting, actually, passionate love of your work can be a great gift for your loving partner or for your children in the right way, as long as that work doesn't take you away from them too much. And a good relationship to the self helps you love others and be more present and real in your work. So they're all mutually supporting. Yeah.
I am struck by the phrase that you mentioned earlier, and that is in your book, The Three Marriages, that half of all conversations are mediated by loss and disappearance. How might we best walk that path?
Well, I think, our great contemplative religious traditions address this, is that there is no possible life you can live that is sincere without having your heart broken. And the theological understanding is that your heart breaks open into something much more present, something much more compassionate, something much more vulnerable, and something that is willing to be part of the conversation without having all the answers. Yeah. And so to be a good doctor, you have to have your heart broken by your work. And to be a good wife or husband or partner, you have to have your heart broken. I think even the longest marriage has had its heart broken many times just to stay together. And then as a parent, you will definitely have your heart broken by your children. And they don't even need to do anything spectacular, but usually they do something spectacular. There is no sincere path you can take. The great thing about having your heart broken by your work, by not knowing how you're going to proceed from this place, is that you have to ask for help. You have to ask for what I call both visible help, which is transactional help, but you also have to ask for invisible help. And we can think of invisible help as, in the ancient sense, you know, of another religious parallel or other realms other than our own. But you can also think about invisible help in a very, very practical way, which is the fact that invisible help is the help that you do not as yet know you need. Yeah. So, you know, if you're a doctor having your heart broken by your work, no matter the prestige of your training or your consultancy or where you've reached in the hierarchy, you're only going to become a better doctor by asking for the right kind of visible and invisible help. You know? And the forms of invisible help have to do with the way I shape my identity in the world. I shape my identity to, in a way that I become a better human being who therefore becomes a far better doctor without losing my technical abilities. And of course, that's just as true of a hospital administrator or of a nurse, you know, or I'd say even of the janitor, you know, who keeps the corridors clean in the hospitals.
So none of us escape.
Exactly. Yeah, we're all witness to, in a hospital especially. I mean, you're seeing people come in and out of there going through life-changing transformations, either through loss or through the beautiful sight of a woman carrying a newborn baby out of the door. Everything is magnified. So it's very easy to create a parallel, smaller story that keeps you from the main conversation. Much more difficult to actually make contact with the raw edge of your life, especially when you've been told that being a doctor means that you have all the answers. Just like, you know, I was taught before I went to the Galapagos Islands that as a young scientist, I had all the answers. That being a good scientist or naturalist guide was being someone who could tell everyone, you know, what the Linnaean nomenclature was for a given animal and what its behaviors were and give people an impression that you actually knew what was going on. Whereas you realize once you get into it that being a good scientist is actually the ability to ask really fierce, accurate, and beautiful questions, often in very unbeautiful moments. And the thing about the discipline of asking beautiful and difficult questions is that you're able to ask them in often very unbeautiful moments. I would say a beautiful question enhances and magnifies the sense of your life, even without having it answered. Yeah. Just by asking the question, you're actually becoming larger and more generous and more here.
David, might there be one of your poems that would help us go deeper into that theme of loss and disappearance?
One immediately comes to mind, looking at the dynamic that we were addressing earlier around half of our conversations being mediated through loss and grief. And this is a poem I wrote many years ago at the beginning of my poetic apprenticeship called The Well of Grief. And it's really about turning your face towards any feeling of loss. I wrote it after I'd lost someone very close to me, passed away. And I just saw how much I wanted to look away from it and not to feel. But it made me think about all the other qualities in our life. And it felt like a well that was drawing me down. So this is the piece I wrote. It's called The Well of Grief. Very short poem. Those who will not slip, those who will not slip beneath the still surface on the well of grief, those who will not slip beneath the still surface on the well of grief, turning down to its black water, turning down to its black water, to the place we cannot breathe. We'll never know the source from which we drink, the secret water, cold and clear. We'll find the darkness glimmering, the small round coins thrown by those who wished for something else. Those who will not slip beneath the still surface on the well of grief, turning down through its black water to the place we cannot breathe. We'll never know the source from which we drink, the secret water cold and clear, nor find in the darkness glimmering the small round coins thrown by those who wish for something else. It's interesting when you look at wells all around the world. There are almost always coins thrown into them. You know, this is a very ancient human instinct. And it was a way in earlier times of making contact with whatever spirit was down there. But it also made me realize, you know, that in today's world, we throw a coin down the well and we make a wish, and in the proverbial wishing well. And the wish is that we do not have to go down ourselves. And so often we throw not only coins, you know, and valuable resources down, but we will throw marriages down there. We will throw relationships with children down there. We will throw our passion and what we care about in our work down there. So long as we do not have to face that raw frontier, you know, where you have to have that difficult conversation. So when I got down into the well, I found all of these coins that I'd thrown down previously with the wish that I did not have to go down myself. Yeah. The well of grief.
Given what we've been talking about and the preparation that's needed for leaders to not only be skilled at what their work is, but also skilled with other tools to deal with the human meaning that occurs in the workplace. What reflection?
Well, in order, yes, what you're inferring is in order to be a good leader, you need not only competency, but you need self-knowledge.
Right.
And at the simplest level, just to understand your effect on other people, to know your pejorative effects on other people too, no matter how good you are in your competencies. And self-knowledge is understanding where my powers are and my gifts, but it's also understanding where my shadow is thrown across other people and where I preemptively attack in order to defend myself, where I'm not willing to listen. Yeah.
What would be the first step in exploring the effect of my conversation on others?
And the great thing about conversation as a way of understanding the basic dynamics of human life is that by definition, conversation is very merciful. You don't have to have the whole conversation at once. All you have to do is begin it. If I'm starting to explore my effect on others, all I have to do to begin with is acknowledge it. I don't need to cure it. I don't need to change it. I don't need to improve myself. I just need to say, oh my God, that's what I'm doing when I say this or say that or do that. This is the effect I have on others. Yeah. So first step, just seeing, hearing, yeah, not turning my face away, turning my face back to it and allowing it to speak back to me in its own voice. Yeah. And a lot of the transformations start to happen just by seeing or hearing, which is a lovely, of course, you know, the masculine psyche has great difficulty with this early on in its maturity. It's something a man, you know, a woman seems to have been born from an evolutionary point of view with this perspective from early on, the power of conversation. And to begin with, we men have to learn how to do this, especially that the conversation itself is very healing without you having actually provided an answer as to where the conversation should go. So this is part of what magnifies our difficulty at the moment is that so many of our leaders are men. And if they haven't learned that central lesson about conversation, then things can just get worse and worse as they get older and supposedly more mature rather than better and better. But then again, there's nothing better than someone who has been through that phase and come out the other side and realize there's another way. And then you get that very powerful, what I call that very powerful, robust vulnerability. Churchill had it, you know, and the best leaders, Nelson Mandela had it. The understanding that of a deep fallibility combined with a willingness to risk yourself in the world.
How do you think leaders today could create a space for the next generation or upcoming leaders to develop more of what you framed as robust vulnerability?
Well, it has to do with taking this inner work seriously. The way we denigrate this kind of work is to call it touchy-feely, yeah, and or whatever other names we like to hang on it. But it's really the hard work. It's the same work you have to do as you move into your later maturity in staying alive, staying interested, staying fit, staying healthy. It's like a discipline. As we get older, we're actually asked to become more disciplined. Everything is much higher stakes. Mistakes you could make with forgiveness at 18 or 19, don't find so much forgiveness when you're 58 or 59, you know, or 48 or 49. You have to cultivate a deep relationship to silence. I often think it's one of the reasons older men are so generally angry. And it's certainly true in North America. There's this, seems to be an inherited anger which comes with being an older male. And I often think it's because the relationship to silence is so necessary in our later years. And when you have no silence, then you do feel besieged by everything. And you especially feel besieged by other people's youth, and especially if you're a man, other younger men's youth. So the ability to have a relationship to silence is a very fierce discipline. And it comes as part of that path of self-knowledge. And it allows us to become a true elder and to generate that generosity, which has been recognized as the gift of eldership towards youth, of mentoring, of teaching, of just making way for, you know, what is about to happen. So to my mind, all of those qualities of true leadership are very fierce disciplines of self-knowledge that we've known about for thousands of years through our great contemplative and religious traditions. And we need to integrate that, those inheritances of mindfulness, with our inheritances of everyday physical competency in the world.
Would you have any advice for how leaders might cultivate that relationship with silence?
Well, it's the same relationship that we have to the unknown. I always say the first step in having a real courageous conversation is to stop having the conversation you're having now. We've been taught and encouraged and shaped into supplying an easy answer, whether the answer was true or not. Just the fact that you had the answer, you were actually rewarded for. And there were many things, you know, I learned in zoology, which are now shown to be complete poppycock, but they were the received facts at the time for which you were rewarded. When I was 13, we studied Hamlet. No 13-year-old boy should be studying Hamlet. You're just not ready for it. And yet the teacher would be asking questions that you were supposed to give a ready answer. Whereas the real answer should be, could you give me another 30 years, sir, and to get enough experience under my belt to understand right. This very, very frightening play. Yeah. So we've been bundled out of a proper relationship with reality by our educational systems. So the false and easy answer closes down silence. Yeah. In silence, it's simply a deep form of attention where you're allowing the world to speak back to you in its own voice, or your spouse to speak back to you in your own voice, or your child instead of the one that you have projected on them through a kind of psychological ventriloquism. So the ability to allow the world to speak back to you. And then the accompanying joy that comes through being able to hear birdsong, to be able to see the sky, you know, to be able to breathe the air. When you're stressed about constantly coming up with the right answer, with the right action, you stop hearing and seeing. There's a beautiful question in the Zen tradition, which is simply a statement. It says, a bird calls, announcing the difference between heaven and hell. A bird calls, announcing the difference between heaven and hell. I remember years ago working with this question for a long time. And finally, one day, I just realized how simple it was. It's heaven is if you hear the bird, and hell is if you didn't hear the bird. If you just walked past, caught in your own little human social bubble, without actually being present in the miracle of physical existence, that is creation. You know? So silence, you know, has to do with this powerful ability to hear a voice, see a quality or a dynamic or a horizon that is other than the one you've manufactured yourself. I've just finished a book of poetry, which is called The Bell and the Black Bird. I'm very excited about. And now that's cleared out of the way, I'm getting back to a book I've been working on for a good few years called A Timeless Way, Seven Steps for Deepening Any Conversation. And it looks at these, what I call seven timeless steps human beings have always employed in order to deepen the conversation. Just no one has collated them together. No one has brought them together in this, I suppose, systemized them. And there are seven steps that I have uncovered, in a sense, just overhearing myself articulate them over the years of my work with what I call the conversational nature of reality or conversational leadership.
Well, deeper conversations, that's something that we're all drawn to. On the themes of disruption, loss, change, mission, and the human spirit, do you have one more poem within you?
Yes. This is looking at that very basic dynamic around allowing the world to come and find you and getting out beyond yourself. Yeah. So this is a new poem from my new book called The Bell and the Blackbird. It's called Just Beyond Yourself. Just beyond yourself. Just beyond yourself. It's where you need to be. Half a step into self-forgetting and the rest restored by what you'll meet. Just beyond yourself. It's where you need to be. Half a step into self-forgetting and the rest restored by what you'll meet. There's a road always beckoning. When you see the two sides of it closing together at that far horizon and deep in your own heart at exactly the same time, that's how you know it's the road you have to follow. That's how you know it's where you have to go. That's how you know. It's just beyond yourself. It's where you need to be. There's a road always beckoning. When you see the two sides of it close together at that far horizon and deep in the foundations of your own heart at exactly the same time, that's how you know it's where you have to go. That's how you know it's the road you have to follow. That's how you know. It's just beyond yourself. It's where you need to be.
Thanks, everyone. I'm Kevin Murphy. This is the Mission Innovation Podcast.